The extraordinary life and legacy of Dr. David Livingstone can only be appreciated when you understand his family, his faith, and his upbringing. The hero of the Battle of Waterloo, the Duke of Wellington, described Dr. David Livingstone as the fighting parson, or the fighting missionary. Jacob Wainwright, who had been rescued from slavery by Dr. David Livingstone, described him as the friend of the African. In fact, I would say he's the best friend Africa ever had. American journalist and explorer Henry Morton Stanley described Dr. David Livingstone as a pious man, a truly pious man, a man deeply endued with real religious instincts. His religion is of the true, practical kind, never losing chance to manifest itself in a quiet, practical way. Never demonstrative or loud. It is always at work, if not indeed, by shining example. Stanley described his attitude when he first arrived in Africa as prejudiced against religion as the worst infidel. Henry Morton Stanley had a very troubled upbringing and an extremely violent past, and he knew nothing but abuse. And so he said he came to Africa tracking Livingstone like a hunter would track an elephant in his sights. He wanted to expose this religious hypocrite, to bring down this Christian missionary who everyone respected. And so he came with bad, prejudiced motives. But the 4 months he spent with David Livingstone in the field along Lake Tanganyika changed his perspective. The example of David Livingstone, who had truly left all to follow Christ, converted Stanley from cynical skepticism and being irreligious to being a convert of Livingstone. When somebody said, Livingstone, lost explorer, failed missionary, never had a convert, Stanley stood up and said, that's a lie. He was never lost. He knew where he was. We just didn't know where he was. He was never lost. And he said, I'm one of his converts. David Livingstone was hailed in his lifetime as the greatest missionary explorer of all time. As one contemporary journalist described it, the Christian's faith in God is strengthened by the author's very survival of every imaginable danger. The abolitionist is inspired by the prospect of stopping the slave trade. Medical men are intrigued by Livingstone's approach to disease and the value of his treatments for fever. The incredible courage and sacrifices of David Livingstone inspired hundreds, multiplied hundreds of men and women to dedicate their lives to missions in Africa. So what can we learn about the family and the upbringing of David Livingstone to understand his faith, his courage, and his vision? David Livingstone was born the 19th of March, 1813, in the industrial town of Blantyre, 8 miles from Glasgow. I need to emphasize that because many people think, oh, I didn't know he was born in Malawi. No, the town Blantyre is named after the birthplace of David Livingstone in Scotland. His father, Neil Livingstone, was a dedicated Christian who had met his future wife, Agnes, when he was apprenticed to a local tailor. Now, you may wonder about this building. You'll see a few different pictures of it. It's the David Livingstone Museum in Glasgow, in Scotland, in Blantyre. And it was in that tenement building that 30 families lived, and his family had one of the rooms there. And, of course, since they've renovated and they've turned it into a museum. He won the hand, we now talk about the father of David Livingstone, Neil Livingstone, he won the hand of the tailor's daughter and became a tea salesman so that he could travel and preach the gospel, distributing evangelistic tracts to his customers door to door. It's said that Neil Livingstone won more converts for Christ than he sold tea. He is a more successful evangelist than he was a salesman. Neil also taught at Sunday school, and he is a zealous member of a local missionary society, persistently promoting prayer meetings and missionary causes. David Livingstone later wrote concerning his father, he deserved my lasting gratitude and homage for presenting me from infancy with a continuously consistent, pious example. Neil Livingstone was also a strict disciplinarian who sought to bring up David in the fear of the Lord. It was very common in those days for parents to be not sparing the rod, and they used canes to drum into them discipline and what's acceptable and what isn't. Even though today that's not common, that was very common then. At age 9, David was challenged to learn the longest chapter in the Bible, Psalm 119, all 176 verses off by heart in order to receive a copy of the New Testament. And he did it twice with only two minor mistakes and received his New Testament as a reward. Because Neil had seen the ravages of alcoholism, he was a teetotaler, and he persuaded his son to follow his example in abstaining from alcohol for life. David Livingston never touched alcohol. David's mother, Agnes, was a gentle, small, delicate woman whose compassionate kindness and loving nature served as a counterbalance to her husband's strict and austere rule. It was said that her son, David, inherited her remarkably bright eyes. Agnes instilled in her family a scrupulous concern for cleanliness and immaculate appearance. When Henry Morton Stanley led his epic journey through the heart of Africa, as he wrote about across the dark continent, he went from the Atlantic Ocean, from the Indian Ocean to the Atlantic Ocean, right across the Congo, through the heart of darkness, down the Congo River, 999-day journey. He told his men, David Livingston shaved every day in the field, and you will shave every day. Extraordinary, the discipline that David Livingston inspired in others. David was born in the last years of the ruinous Napoleonic Wars, which had devastated Europe. The economic impact of 25 years of French Revolutionary and Napoleonic Wars had left many unemployed in England, and an economically depressed environment. Now, the Livingstons lived a very frugal life on a minuscule budget. The Livingston family lived in a single room, this room, 10 feet by 14 feet. 10 feet by 14 feet. A family of seven were in that room. Two baby boys died in infancy. David had an older surviving brother, John. Another brother, Charles, and two sisters, Janet and Agnes, were born after David, and they lived in this tenement. There was neither hot nor cold running water in the tenement building, no plumbing at all. David had to walk many times a day down the tightly curved brick staircase to fetch water from the pump in the yard. This is the only pump for 30 families, and heave it back up the stairs along the corridor of the third floor to the family room. The Livingstons shared the tenement with 24 other families. At night, mattresses were pulled out from under the parents' bed, which was set in a recess in the wall. Privacy was non-existent. The family cooked, ate, sewed, studied, slept in that single room. David Livingston borrowed extensively from the local library, particularly books on travel and science. Now, I must say, this picture is a bit imaginative. There wasn't another room for the mother to open the door to see him sitting at the table reading, but this is just the way some children's books have depicted it. William Wilberforce's book, Practical Christianity, had a major impact on David Livingston's life. William Wilberforce was the Member of Parliament who dedicated his life to fighting slavery. And clearly, Wilberforce's book, Practical Christianity, and his example, clearly influenced Livingston's lifelong crusade against the slave trade. Now, there's an incident early in the life of David Livingston which is not recorded in any of the books of David Livingston, and Livingston never referred to it. But we know about it because his father discovered it and wrote it in a letter to the London Missionary Society, and it's on their records. At age about 9 years old, David Livingston was reading on the banks of the Clyde River, not far from his home, near the cotton mill. And he suddenly was woken up from his concentration in the book by a scream of a young girl. There was a little girl who was having a game, an adventure with her baby brother. Her baby brother was a toddler, and they were in a boat rowing, and she had lost the oars, and the current was carrying them inexorably towards the paddle wheel of the mill, which, of course, would crush the boat and kill both children occupants. David did not hesitate. He plunged into the icy river. He rescued them both and saw them back to their home and never said a word about it. However, the parents came to tell David's parents, and David's father later put this in a letter when he was asked to give a reference to his son for the London Missionary Society when he applied to that mission. At age 10, David began his full-time employment, 14 hours a day, six days a week for the next 10 years. He was working as a cotton mill worker, a threader at the Monteith and Cotton, Monteith and Company cotton spinning factory. He was a piecer to repair broken threads and spinning frames. His day began when the bell rang at 5:30 a.m. every morning, and he had to quickly dress, wash, get something to drink, and work would begin at 6 a.m. and continue till 8 p.m. The workers in the cotton mill had to work in tremendous heat and humidity, which was considered essential for the production of thread. Steam temperatures of 80 to 90 degrees Fahrenheit were considered ideal for the production of cotton thread. Every day, David would walk an average of 34 kilometers a day, much of this in a crawling or stooping position amongst or over machinery or balancing over it. You can imagine the tremendous physical training this was for his later transcontinental expeditions across Africa. Piecers received constant beatings from their supervisors to keep them moving through long shifts despite fatigue and exhaustion. That was not considered child abuse, that was considered totally normal. Child labor from age 10 was quite common. In fact, most of his contemporaries began their full-time work at age 6, and it's only because of Agnes's mother insisting that he'd be allowed to get more homeschooling till he reached 10 that he only started his full-time employment at age 10. Many children started much earlier than that. Yet David used his first week's wages. I mean, what would you use your first week's wages for? And remember, he's 10 years old. He bought rudiments of Latin. Imagine that as a 10-year-old boy's high priority. David managed to read in the factory by balancing his book on a portion of the spinning jenny so that he could catch sentence after sentence as he rushed about for his day's work. In this way, he maintained fairly constant study, undisturbed by the roar of the machinery. Less than 10% of the children who worked in the cotton mills ever learned to read or write. David not only learned to read and write, he taught himself Latin, Greek, and Hebrew. And after work, he would attend a night school from 8 p.m. to 10 p.m. Then he returned home to study, often until midnight. And his mother frequently had to take his books away before he would actually go to sleep. At age 12, David Livingston came under intense conviction of sin, and he experienced a radical conversion to Christ. He wrote, "In the glow of love that Christianity inspired, I resolved to devote my life to the alleviation of human misery." He wrote, "The salvation of men ought to be the chief desire and aim of every Christian." He made a resolution that he would give to the cause of missions all that he might earn beyond what was required for his subsistence. At age 13, he attended an extra Latin class, and when all the other students gave up, he alone remained in the class, and the school teacher cancelled the lessons, not seeing this overzealous son of the tea merchant as worthy of his attention. But that didn't stop him. David continued to learn Latin on his own and mastered it. David's grandfather, Neil Livingston, Sr., also had an impact on the upbringing of David. He had been a tenant farmer on the island of Ulva, off the west coast of Scotland. He was evicted by the English to open up the area for a vast sheep farm, so he just lost his land and ancestral property. He passed on what he had learned from his grandfather. "I have searched most carefully through all the traditions of our family, and I never could discover that there was a dishonest man among any of your forebears. If therefore any of you or your children should take to dishonest ways, it will not be because it runs in your blood. I leave this prospect with you. Be honest." Another man who influenced David Livingston was Thomas Burke, an old soldier, who would ring his bell to shatter the peace and quiet of Blantyre every Sunday morning to rouse people to attend his early morning prayer meeting. I don't know how popular a person like that would be in our communities, walking around Sunday morning, clanging a bell, you know, come out, gather up for an early morning prayer meeting before church. Burke was abrupt, he was direct and challenging, as you'd expect a soldier to be, but the Livingston family faithfully supported him. Another man who impressed David Livingston was David Hogg, who from his deathbed challenged this young boy, "Now, lad, make religion the everyday business of your life. Not a thing of fits and starts. For if you do not, temptation and other things will get the better of you." 18 32 was a special watershed year for the Livingston family. Neil Livingston, dissatisfied with the spiritual growth and life of the Church of Scotland, changed his membership to the Free Church of Scotland. This required the Livingstons to now walk to Hamilton, a nearby village, for the Sunday worship services, because there was no such free church in Blantyre. Although they received many invitations to dine with families of the congregation, they chose, as typical Scottish Christians, who actually are very proud and unwilling to accept charity, they chose to carry their own food and not impose upon the limited resources of other families, knowing that others were also struggling in the economically depressed climate that followed the Napoleonic Wars. And they therefore ate their own Sunday lunch on their own, and they gave the children the one treat of the week, which is a barley sweet each. One sweet a week. That was the luxury. The Free Church in Hamilton was strong supporters of missions. In 1833, William Wilberforce's lifelong crusade against slavery was successful. Slavery was abolished throughout the British Empire by an Act of Parliament. This inspired an even greater vision for missions, because those who had been freed from physical slavery now needed to be freed from spiritual slavery. Missionaries were needed to go to the ends of the earth, following the example of people like William Carey. Books and tracts from the revival movement sweeping America now reached Scotland and created such excitement and deepening of spiritual life and vision. David Livingston then received a pamphlet written by Carl Gustloff of the Netherlands Missionary Society. In it, Gustloff appealed for medical missionaries to go to China. David was inspired by how a medical missionary could be much more effective in converting the lost. He had learned enough Latin to be able to understand most medical terms, and he was remarkably well-read, and he could easily pass the university entrance exams. His chief obstacle, of course, would be lack of finances. He came from a very poverty-stricken family. But through great determination, he then saved enough money during the next 18 months to put himself through medical school and theological college. No bursaries were available in those days. There was no such thing as scholarships. There was no free education anywhere. You had to save up and pay for it. At age 23, David set out on foot to begin his theological and medical studies in Glasgow. From 1836 to 1838, he benefited from the best theological and medical training available at that time. Each weekend, he had walked back to Blantyre. So it was a four-hour walk to college on Monday morning and a four-hour walk back on Friday afternoon. He would be in nearby Glasgow for the training through the week. So he'd have to get up at 4 in the morning to make class by 8 a.m. In Glasgow. And he would refuse every offer of lifts by horse carts, preferring the long walk, often in the snow. Remember, this is Scotland in winter, in order to strengthen his muscles for his chosen career in missions. In his second year at college, David applied to the London Missionary Society, and David's father was concerned that his son's application had omitted important facts. And there, without David's knowledge, Neil Livingston wrote to the London Missionary Society board, informing them of his son's diligence in attending lectures after hours, all the way through his time at the cotton mill, refusing offers of a lift to town. We wouldn't know that otherwise. His refusals of secure teaching posts offered, of his early quest for Latin proficiency from age 10, of his hard work, sacrificial lifestyle, and dedication to study. In response to the question of whether he was married or engaged, we read on David Livingston's application form, which is still at the London Missionary Society: unmarried, under no engagement relating to marriage, never made proposal of marriage, nor conducted myself so to any woman as to cause her to suspect I intended anything related to marriage. And, so far as my present wishes are concerned, I should prefer going out unmarried, that I might be without that care which the concerns of family necessarily induced, and give myself wholly to the work. Probably the longest answer to the question of are you married or not on any of these missionary application forms. It gives you a bit of an insight to his thinking. 8 months after his application, David was finally invited to London, 30th of August, 1838, for an interview. After a second interview in September, the directors accepted David Livingston as a missionary candidate on probation. He was placed under the mentorship of Reverend Richard Cecil, who described David as having sense and quiet vigour, whose temper is good and his character is substantial. However, at his first preaching opportunity, David froze in the pulpit. He abruptly declared, "Friends, I've forgotten all that I have to say," and he hurried out of the pulpit. The directors of the London Missionary Society seriously considered rejecting his candidacy. Can you imagine? However, a wise man pleaded hard that his probation should be extended, and at a future preaching engagement, he proved himself a capable and energetic communicator. One lady in Ongar wrote of David Livingston, "I never knew anyone who gave me more the idea of power over other men. Such power as our Saviour showed while on earth, the power of love and purity combined." During his studies, David wrote to his sisters, urging them to seek to be uncommon Christians, that is, eminently holy and devoted servants of the Most High. "Let us seek, and with the conviction that we cannot do without it, that selfishness be extirpated, pride banished, unbelief driven from the mind, every idol dethroned, everything hostile to holiness and opposed to the divine will crucified, that holiness to the Lord may be engraved in our heart and evermore characterize our whole conduct. This is what we ought to strive after. This is the way to be happy. This is what our Savior loves. Entire surrender of heart. May He enable us by His Spirit to persevere until we attain it." That's just a letter to his sisters. It is noted that David earnestly sought first the kingdom of God and His righteousness. He steadfastly sought the Lord's will for his life, and he persevered through every problem. David Livingston was described as an idealist, an eccentric, bookworm loner. He took his task and his calling most seriously. Whatever he did, he performed thoroughly. His character was uncompromising. He was inflexible in his adherence to his word. There you see his signature, and his word was his bond. Dr. Risdon Bennett, one of the Royal College of Physicians, described David Livingston as pure and noble, simple, modest, unassuming, and self-reliant. Dr. Bennett wrote, "He is struck by the amount of knowledge that David Livingston had already acquired of those things, those subjects that constitute the foundation of medical science." Now, David Livingston's plan had been to be a medical missionary to China, but this was frustrated when the Opium War erupted. The London Missionary Society declared China is closed. It was at that opportune time that Robert Moffat, the London Missionary Society missionary, conducted speaking engagements in London. Isn't God's timing perfect? Robert Moffat inspired David Livingston as he spoke of the smoke of 1,000 villages that has never seen a missionary. And David switched his focus from Asia to Africa, and praise God he did. While attending a meeting of the Society for the Extinction of the Slave Trade and for the Civilization of Africa in Exeter Hall, 1st of June 1840, David Livingston heard T. Foxbill Buxton speak of the importance of commerce and Christianity to defeat the slave trade in Africa. And you've got to understand Livingston's later quotes in his life of, he goes to open a path for commerce and Christianity in Africa. And some people who can only think politically, they think, oh, capitalism. No, no, commerce. He was thinking lawful commerce, that the people of Africa may have something more to trade than their neighbors. Selling their children and their neighbors and people captured from neighboring tribes, which is what was going on. He was talking about lawful commerce, that the people would be trading crafts that they have made or products that they have grown or things from the countryside instead of trading in human flesh and the human species, as it was put. So when he's speaking about opening up Africa for commerce and Christianity, he's talking about destroying the slave trade. Because how are you going to destroy the slave trade without commerce and Christianity? This was very much in his thinking from this meeting and from, of course, reading William Wilberforce's book. You've got to understand the context in which these comments were made. Africans would only be delivered from the slave trade when they had an alternative to selling their own people to pay for the beads, the cloth, the guns, and the trinkets that they were coveting. During his final medical exams, David Livingstone argued with the board, who were not convinced about the usefulness of the stethoscope. And David Livingstone's unorthodox views were noted, but he qualified with a licentiate of the Royal Faculty of Physicians and Surgeons, November 1840. He was way ahead of his time on so many things. On a bleak November morning, 1840, the Livingstone family rose at 5 a.m., and the 27-year-old David Livingstone read Psalm 121 to his family. He then read Psalm 135. The family bowed in prayer, and then Neil walked his son to the Glasgow docks and saw his son embark on his great African adventure. David would never see his parents again. On the 20th of November, 1840, David was ordained as a missionary in the Albion Street Chapel. None of his family present. They were too poor to be able to travel that far. On the 8th of December, he set sail in the George for Cape Town, South Africa. David had experienced very little childhood or adolescence. In his upbringing, he had little or no play or recreation. Against all odds, he had achieved already far more than would have been thought humanly possible for somebody born into such a poverty-stricken background, such a disadvantaged background. To achieve what he had, Livingstone had to be decisive, goal-orientated, and inflexible. As time went on, he became less and less flexible, and he showed little or no time for those with lower standards of devotion to Christ or commitment to the Great Commission. To those who said that the work at home must be complete before any missions be engaged in abroad, Livingstone responded, "All men have the right to hear the word of God. No nation ought to hoard the gospel like a miser. The light that shines the furthest shines brightest at home. You don't defraud Scotland by blessing Africa." Livingstone describes his 3-month journey to Cape Town. "A little vessel went reeling and staggering over the waves as if she had been drunk. Our trunks were perpetually breaking from the lashings, tossed from one side of the cabin to the other. Huddled together in glorious confusion, imagine, if you can, a ship in a fit of epilepsy." David befriended Captain Donaldson and learned all that he could concerning the quadrant and the sextant, and frequently staying up past midnight to take lunar observations and work out directions using the stars. As the ship rocked and reeled over the perilous seas, Livingstone studied theology. Finally, a raging storm split the foremast of the ship and had to put into Rio de Janeiro to have it repaired. And David described battling profusely to refuse bottles of liquor that were offered to him from all sides in Brazil. The Brazilians expressed shock that any Englishman should refuse alcohol. For many of his countrymen, and seamen in particular, had continually disgraced themselves in the streets of Rio by intoxication, drunkenness, as he said. David handed out gospel tracts at the notorious waterfront bar and narrowly escaped with his life as 20 drunk, angry sailors assaulted him. He engaged in ministry at the local hospital. He witnessed raging, drunken delirium. He shared the gospel with a dying French sailor, and he urged him to trust Christ alone for his eternal salvation. I don't know how many people are aware that David Livingstone is the one who identified the treatment for malaria as quinine and mosquitoes as the cause of malaria. He was decades ahead of his time. According to medical science at that stage, malaria was caused by bad air, swamp fever. The word malaria in Latin, mal, bad, area, air, bad air. It shows they believed that malaria is caused by bad air. Their solution, high roofs, and that's why the colonial buildings all had high roofs, to let the bad air rise. They were convinced that the solution to malaria was having high roofs. And David Livingstone's the first person to have pointed out, no, mosquitoes cause it. Not only did he identify mosquitoes as the cause of malaria, but the pregnant female mosquito who lays her eggs in people somewhere around 11 o'clock at night through till 5 in the morning, in the midnight hours. And the medical science people at the time scoffed at his reports, but he was proved right. He was dead right. You can get bitten by a mosquito at other times of day, but you can only get malaria when a pregnant female mosquito lays the eggs roughly between 11 at night and 5 in the morning. If you're under your mosquito net, and you've gotten rid of all mosquitoes within the net, you can't get malaria if you're there between about 11 at night and 5 in the morning. That's how observant David Livingstone was. And more than that, he identified quinine as the solution. And quinine, I remember these in Rhodesia, Livingstone's rouser. That's what it would say. Because the treatment for malaria was Livingstone's rouser quinine, which came from a bush in Brazil. His ship, the Forerunner, that had been, the George that he had traveled on, there we go, it's about the ship he went on, the George, he was using this in order to treat malaria. He came across the quinine bush while walking outside of Rio de Janeiro, exploring, and as always he took clippings of trees and different seeds, and he planted these when he came to Africa. He was always observant of what was going on, and he tried many different treatments for malaria and found that the quinine bush that he had taken clippings of from Brazil was the perfect treatment to enable you to survive malaria. And that is why David Livingstone was able to survive fever on about 60 occasions in Africa, because he had pioneered this, and he was decades ahead of medical science recognizing that he's dead right. That is why he managed to survive 26 years in the field, walking around Africa, getting malaria many a time, but he knew the treatment. David Livingstone placed on the cover of his book, Livingstone's Travels, or Missionary Travels and Researches in South Africa, as it was originally called, he places a tsetse fly on the cover. Many people said, Africa, all the lions, the snakes, the crocodiles. He said, actually, mosquitoes kill far more people than all the lions, snakes, and crocodiles. And the tsetse fly, sleeping sickness. And that's why he put the tsetse fly on the fly leaf of his book cover. On the 17th of March, 1841, Livingstone sighted the majestic Table Mountain as the George edged into Table Bay. And thus began one of the most incredible missionary careers of the best friend Africa ever had. He walked across what are today 12 great countries. He walked all the way across the Cape, first from Port Elizabeth, up through Kraaifontein to Kuruman. He walked through Botswana, he walked all the way back to Cape Town, he walked from Cape Town all the way across the Cape, across Botswana, across what is today Zambia and Angola. He walked from Angola, from Luanda, the capital, from the Atlantic, all the way across the Indian Ocean. He walked across Angola, Zambia, Zimbabwe, and Mozambique. He came back and he explored the Rovuma River. He explored and studied all the way around Lake Malawi, Lake Tanganyika, walked across Tanzania, Zambia, Malawi, Mozambique, Burundi. He died on his knees in what is today Zambia. We have had many a people come to our mission and ask, is it in walking distance? And my answer is, yes. Everywhere in Africa is in walking distance. David Livingstone proved that. Question is, do you have the time? I've heard of students from this college not turning up for a semester because they said they couldn't get transport. If they had walked, they would have got here in short order. Everywhere is in walking distance. David Livingstone proved that, and he walked across an Africa that did not have roads, bridges, or purified water. The best friend Africa ever had. One of the victorious Christians who changed the world. One of the lives of courage and faith. One of the heroes of the faith. You see these are in your library. In 2013, we organized Livingstone 200 celebrations, marking the 200th anniversary of the birth of Dr. David Livingstone, and it culminated in major events in Victoria Falls, Livingstone, the city of Livingstone, Zambia. And this is part of our Livingstone 200 events. We sent out a mission team that went across the 12 countries where Livingstone ministered. Of course, we cheated, we drove. But we covered in a 5.5 month mission many of these 12 countries, documenting the growth of church, delivering tons of Bibles and books to many of the churches that have benefited from the seed sowing he did. And we set up this website called Livingstone 200. On it you can find biographical articles, picture galleries, resources, links to Livingstone museums, Livingstone's writings online. And we set up a Dr. David Livingstone Facebook page, dr.davidlivingstone. You will find some Facebook page just called David Livingstone, but ours is dr or Dr. Dot David Livingstone. And you'll find a lot of materials useful there and ongoing, and you can share it with your friends if you're on social media. We also set up Livingstone Fellowship. And on this, we've got a huge digital library, Bibles, all kinds of... you can receive Bible studies in many different languages and links to audio sermons, videos, and others. Of course, our frontline missionsa.org website has lots as well. If you're on social media, you can track our Frontline Fellowship social media. Many of our history articles we put on reformationsa.org website. And the Facebook page for that is Reformation 500. Here is the birthplace and the home of David Livingstone in this tenement building. And they today have a visitor center, museum, a world globe. And so this is the beautiful site of the David Livingstone Museum in Blantyre in Scotland today. Many churches have statues and memorials to Dr. David Livingstone. This is a statue outside the Livingstone Museum in Zambia. Stained glass windows in Africa remembering Dr. David Livingstone. These are just different ones we've picked up in our travels. You can even see in Scotland they'll have David Livingstone on their money. And Malawi, on the 100th anniversary of David Livingstone's death, produced stamps in commemoration of him. In Glasgow, in Blantyre, there are memorials to Dr. David Livingstone, probably the greatest Scotsman of all time, and certainly the greatest friend Africa ever had. You can find museums and monuments around Africa. We have set up memorials. Our mission headquarters in Cape Town is called Livingstone House. These are just some of my Livingstone first edition books, which I've acquired, some of which are very hard to acquire, like the Zambezi expedition, and Stanley's books too, like Stanley's In Darkest Africa and Through the Dark Continent. This is a real treasure trove of sketches of David Livingstone and his great work, which appears in many of our presentations and articles as well. Even today, people are writing books on David Livingstone, on his legacy, and the letters of David Livingstone. We've got books on these as well, and both good and shallow through to bigger and more detailed and in-depth books on David Livingstone. These are just some of the resources, and then we've put summaries on Victorious Christians Who Changed the World, Heroes of the Faith, and of course, In the Greatest Century of Missions book. His vision was Africa for Christ, and so as a mission, it is our joy and our privilege to seek to reap where Livingstone sowed. Any questions, any comments? Yes?
I have a comment, sir. Back in BE, we have the David Livingstone Hospital as well as the high school today.
Port Elizabeth?
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Interesting. In the city of Livingstone in Zambia, where we concluded our Livingstone 200 celebrations with Zambian National TV and a radio there in the mayor's office, and there was the David Livingstone High School, there was the David Livingstone Teacher Training College, and had 8 different statues of David Livingstone. Some had been built just that year in the city of Livingstone. So extraordinary. You can go all over Africa and find his name must be about the most respected name in Africa. I don't think there's been a missionary more beloved in this continent. Yes?
Can you please help me understand the history behind the continent of Africa being called Dark Continent?
Yes, sure. It's been called the Dark Continent because there were no written records, no maps, and almost nobody knew anything reliable about Africa. And so the maps that people had of Africa were actually quite shamefully false. I'll show some of them later. Extraordinary how many people in Africa were just not known of. The prevailing view at the time was Africa in the center was just one big desert. And Livingstone's the one who put paid to that view, where they were convinced that Africa was on the hinterland, one huge desert. But David Livingstone's the one who came and he filled in the blanks. He showed that no, David Livingstone showed Africa's full of lakes and rivers and mountains and plateaus and savanna, and he opened up people's eyes on the Dark Continent. The Dark Continent was called dark because nobody seemed to know anything much about it. And there was no maps or written languages. That was the main reason. Other questions? Yes.
Wanted to understand something about the financial aspect of the mission trips of the mission. How is it like, who are the ones who are funding these mission trips? Because I understand all his achievements, they need money.
Indeed. Well, he lived an extremely poverty-stricken life. He didn't need much. I mean, he regarded tea as a luxury, so you can imagine. David Livingstone had very little support, and so he basically lived off the land. He hunted. He was involved, whether through fishing or hunting, getting the food. He had very little. He traveled with next to no funding at all. Only his second missionary expedition, which was the Zambezi expedition, received any funding. And that was the most disastrous one of all. And that the British government funded for him to help explore the Zambezi River and to put an end to the slave trade there. So Livingstone was never well funded. Yes.
Okay, so thank you, and we thank God for this legend of faith that came to Africa. But my question is, like we read that Moffat came to Burma, and he came to the Ghana people, and Livingstone came to Zambia. So when we entered the country, how did they learn the language of the country or of the village they were living into? How did they communicate? Were there no people like African people who taught them the language, who were so close to them that they taught them the African language, the
yes.
And what happened to these people? Because I believe they should be the first one who received the gospel, and then they will help them as they evangelize.
Yes.
But we don't hear anything about the African names of the people, that this one, he taught me Vemba, this one, he taught me this language I was working with. Were they working in isolation?
Actually, there is quite a bit of details about the people who they interacted with and learned from, and the early converts. Those details are available in the books, and it just is a fact that most people are not paying attention. But the example of Robert Moffat is Moffat came and he settled amongst Tswana and he learned the language and he mastered the language and he translated the Bible into Tswana, which is a great achievement. David Livingstone is very different. Livingstone never seemed to work through an interpreter. Now, just about every missionary worked through interpreters for a long time while they acquired the language. Livingstone was extraordinary. He seemed to have a gift of tongues. He acquired languages. He preached the gospel in Tswana, in Bemba, in Chichewa, in languages from one side of Africa to the other, in Swahili. He acquired languages. He would go to a village and he would sit outside the village. He wouldn't just go in and try and see the chief. He'd sit outside. He understood the culture. He would wait, read, study, whatever he's doing, and maybe treating people who came to him for medical help. He'd wait till the chief invited him in. And then he'd go and he'd ask permission to do whatever he was wanting to do there. And he would pay attention. He'd be noting in his books what people were saying and so on, and he'd be asking questions. And he devised his own dictionaries, worked out the languages, and came to acquire the languages. But this is extraordinary, because we can pick up dictionaries, language courses, phrase books. There's so many ways that we are helped in language acquisition today, and it's still hard. Without anything, I mean, he's going to languages that didn't have a written language, and there was no dictionary, and there wasn't anything put to paper. And he acquired it. So an extraordinary, I can't see evidence that Livingstone preached to a translator. I can't say he never did, maybe he did, but that would have been an exception. From what I can see, he was one of those few people who acquired the language. Now, William Carey is another great linguist. He translated the Bible or New Testament and Gospels into 36 different languages. William Carey. Nobody has ever seen anything like that in history. So when you talk about the gift of tongues, some people think somebody babbling in some corner, karabashambalakatatata. I think this is tongues. It's gibberish. The gift of tongues in Acts chapter 2, they preached the gospel and people understood the gospel in their languages. The gift of tongues in the Bible was an understandable language, not some gibberish chanted by somebody trying to get attention to himself. So, to me, David Livingstone, William Carey stand out as exceptional examples of the gift of tongues. Now, let me just show you some of the maps of Africa. You asked why they call Africa the Dark Continent. Just look at these kind of embarrassing, ridiculous, pathetic, unbelievable, you've got to be kidding. And this was, they all heard about the mountains of the moon. Why the mountains of the moon? Well, don't you love that? Unknown. And these were the maps. And then when they finally were going around the continent, they had an idea that was the Nile. And the Nile goes all the way down to South Africa, which is why if you go to Kruger National Park, they'll show you that is the Nile crocodile. They're not the Nile crocodile. They've got nothing to do with the Nile River. But when the people first saw the crocodiles there, they thought, ah, these must be the crocodiles of the Nile that we heard about in Cleopatra's day. Because they thought the Nile River came all the way down to, well, they thought the Limpopo was the Nile River too. So there was a lot of confusion. And even 16th century, shame. When David Livingstone came, that was the map of Africa. One big, huge, unknown and unexplored territory in the middle. They were convinced that was desert. And David Livingstone's the one who proved, no, it's filled with lakes and rivers and plateaus. And he's the one who gave the understanding. He drew the first map of the Zambezi River. The discipline, every day, even when sick, he was measuring with the thermometer in the water, and as the water boiled, he'd see at what temperature it boils, and he'd work out the altitude. The sextant, he's working out for the stars, whether we're in the longitude and latitude. Unbelievable discipline. I've heard people laugh about the fact, how can you say David Livingstone discovered Victoria Falls? Everybody knew about Victoria Falls. Well, maybe not. When Livingstone saw the great smoke rising at the distance on the Zambezi River, said, what is that? And the local people said, Musi Oyatanya, the smoke that thunders. What makes it thunder? The spirits. Have you been there? No. Nobody goes there. It's a place of danger. I mean, the noise sounds like thunderous. And of course people were afraid. And so David Livingstone borrowed a canoe. He knew there's got to be something really spectacular here. And he, from the size of the river, he assumed it must be a waterfall. He got a canoe and he went all the way. And he went down the river and he stopped on, imagine the courage, knowing if water's getting faster and faster and more white and more turbulent. And he stops his canoe just in time on what we today call Livingstone Island. He crawls the edge, and that picture of these people standing with spears there, that's imagination of some foolish British artist. They weren't there. Nobody was wanting to try this. He crawls the edge, and he lets out a rope with lead weights, and he measures 310 feet high. And this is a sketch. Notice, Victoria Falls, 310 feet deep. That's what it is. 310 feet deep. 1,860 yards wide. That's what it is. Now, how did he pace that out? It's a waterfall. How do you measure a waterfall? He didn't have satellites, GPS, drones, helicopters. So how did he do this? He marks out 400 paces, 200 paces between this gorge and that. And he sketches these. Now, there's no place where you can go where you can actually see this perspective. I mean, today we've got drones, we've got helicopters, fine, but he sort of elevated himself to a position where nobody could be and gave a picture of what the falls looks like from the side, and that's what it is. He is accurate. There's no mountain where you can get this view from, and yet he drew this showing the different gorges leading from Victoria Falls, and that's what it's like. So the discipline sketches and details, and when he went there, he saw the most incredible concentration of wildlife in all of his 26 years walking across Africa. He never saw more wildlife than at Victoria Falls, which proves that nobody went there. So there wasn't hunting. So animals gathered there. It was a sanctuary where they were safe from hunters. And even a few years later, when he brought Thomas Baines, one of the greatest artists of the Victorian era, Thomas Baines did a lot of great sketches on Victoria Falls. You can see there was still such a vast amount of wildlife there because it was a sanctuary. Few people were coming to hunt there at that stage. So David Livingstone may not have been the first person to ever see Victoria Falls, maybe. But maybe he was. But he certainly was the first to make it known, to name it, to map it, to chart it, to measure it. And he said angels at creation must have gazed at such sights in flight. And this is one of the seven natural wonders of the world. And it's known to the world because of his work. And he actually is the one who first saw it on the 16th of November in 1856. And we had the opportunity to conclude our Livingstone 200 celebrations at Victoria Falls. Right, you had a question.
I wanted to ask something that came in my mind in line with the question to our brother.
Yes.
In this, they say dark Africa, the name dark. But,
dark continent.
Yeah, we find out throughout the Bible that there's a part of Africa which is mentioned there in the Bible. And now, how come Africa were not in the map?
Well, the main reason would be the Sahara Desert. The Sahara Desert is a tremendous obstacle. And so the parts of Africa well known were Cyrene, what today is Libya. The Egypt, obviously, the superpower at the crossroads of Africa and Asia. Ethiopia was well known, and the Queen of Sheba is believed to have come from Ethiopia as well. So Ethiopia, Egypt, and Sudan is where the gospel came first. But now there's this big barrier to get south of the Sahara Desert to the rest of Africa. And that would have been a tremendous obstacle. Then you would have also had the hostility of different tribes and prevalence of slave trading, slave raids, cannibalism that would have made people insular and suspicious of others or attacking anybody who came that was a stranger. So many things would have conspired to keep Africa the dark continent, including the diseases. So, for example, when the Portuguese first sent an exploration group into Monomotapa, what today is Zimbabwe, from Mozambique, they sent in a massive force, and they just about all died of malaria. And, of course, they didn't know what caused it. They didn't realize it was the mosquitoes and so on. And that keeps things pretty dark, because explorers, traders, hunters, soldiers, priests, missionaries, whatever, they went in and they disappeared, never seen again. Maybe they got killed, maybe they got eaten, maybe they got wiped out by wildlife, maybe the crocodiles got them, malaria, sleeping sickness, who knows? And so the continent had this mystique and this fear, and people were afraid of going there because, you know, the last people that we know that went there never came back. So you can see how that would have all conspired together. Any other questions or comments?
Thank you. I think several times you talked about the French Revolution. What was it? Did you mention it in passing?
Yes. The French Revolution of 1789 was the first truly communist revolution. In fact, Karl Marx and Frederick Engels refer to the French Revolution as the first great communist revolution. So it was communism. They chopped off 40,000 heads with a guillotine, big machine, big blade coming down, and they shot another 300,000 people in public executions, and something in the region of 6 million people were killed in the 25 years Napoleonic Wars that flowed out of the French Revolution. So it was the biggest upheaval and chaos. It was very anti-Christian. They destroyed a lot of churches. They tried to abolish the 7-day work week and have a 10-day work week. They tried to change the calendar from being AD and BC to 1793 was the year one, and they tried a new calendar totally with a 10-day work week. Of course, it didn't work. They were very anti-Christ. They wanted to eradicate Christianity completely. So the French Revolution was the prototype which inspired the Russian Revolution or the Bolshevik Revolution and, of course, the Chinese Revolution of Mao Zedong. It's what inspired Mengistu to murder so many millions of Ethiopian people. It's what's inspired Mugabe with his nonsense and all of these characters. So the French Revolution is the prototype. It's a prototype revolution. While they promised them liberty, they themselves are slaves of depravity. So why are you laughing? You know that it's true. Yes, another question.
Okay, I want to ask you, what were the challenges these first missionaries coming to Africa, what were the challenges which they were facing? Sometimes I can imagine that it's the first time to see a white person, a black person, and him carrying a gun as well. So what were the challenges? What were the difficulties they were facing?
Yes, well, first of all, you must understand, everybody in Africa always carried weapons. Were they carrying spears, shields, bows and arrows? He's carrying a rifle. I mean, normal people carried a weapon. Why would they not? So there wouldn't have been, oh, you're a missionary, how can you be carrying a gun? No, there's none of that. It was perfectly normal. Of course he'd be carrying a weapon. I'd just be wondering, where's his army? I mean, we travel around in big groups and packs, so how can he come on his own? And so there would have been that maybe, but the idea that he had a weapon, why not? First of all, it's used for hunting and protecting yourself from wild animals, and of course wild people, or slave traders, people who want to attack you, kill you. Everyone would have a weapon. Remember there was a time when every single man had a sword or a dagger or a spear. They all walked around with weapons all the time. And in fact, today you can see that it's probably got to go back to that because we've got so many criminals out there who are so violent that it doesn't make sense that our people today are being disarmed, and we think we should be disarmed. It's not logical. We've forgotten the way most of history has been. Most people in most of history have always been armed. That's been normal. Just like the animals always go around with their horns, tusks, teeth, claws, talons, you know. I mean, the idea that we've all got to be disarmed, why should we be disarmed when the criminals are all armed? So what's strange about a missionary traveling with weapons? William Carey, in his book, An Inquiry into the Obligation of Christians to Use Means for the Conversion of the Heathen, the book that launched the modern missionary movement, in chapter 5, he gives a checklist of essential items you must take to the field. On the first page, powder, shot, knives. I mean, he took it for granted that weapons would be what you took. You don't normally think of William Carey carrying a weapon, but he did. Not often, because he was too busy doing too many other things, but he had his weapons. But he was at a base in Serampore in India, whereas David Livingstone was walking on the road. Now, of course, going down the road, anything can happen. I mean, from Muslim slave raiders to a buffalo attacking. So, why would he not have a weapon? It is a bizarre twist of the 21st century people that we're living in such a violent time, we think that it's wrong for a person to have weapons. It's totally natural. Yes?
Yes, Master, I think you should to do with what one of the women had asked. We see these missionaries, from the record, we talk about missionaries coming to set up a mission station And we see that they stayed in Africa for more than 50 years.
Yes.
If a mission has been in a place for more than 20 years, probably they could have people that they have raised among the people that they are serving. They were in Africa. Now, the history that we have is only about the Robert Moffat and the others. Of course, their names are coming up. Now, we want to know, after their work in Africa, are there Africans that got this gospel and rose and took up the responsibility and the challenge to spread the gospel in Africa?
Well, obviously they did, because we have 500 million Christians in Africa today. So when David Livingstone arrived, there were only 5 million Christians in all of Africa. Most of those were in Egypt and Ethiopia. And today there are 500 million people in Africa who call themselves Christians. So obviously they were successful. The gospel came to all of us, did it not?
Now, how come we don't know anything about them?
Well, you can't say we don't know anything about them. We do. It just is that most of our media doesn't bother to read, and it just is listening to lies of Hollywood, who aren't going to tell you about the Christian history. Now, of course, there were many, many people who did a lot of great things that we do not know about. We'll find out in heaven. But the ones that we do know about, the ones we do know about are the ones who wrote reports, wrote books, and that have been preserved. Because, of course, some books have been destroyed. There's been a lot of wars, bombings, Muslims, this and the other. So some books and libraries have been destroyed, like the Library of Alexandria. But on the other hand, what we know tells us of those stories that, of course, are the ones that we're sharing. I mean, I can only report to you about what we know about. We aren't all-knowing, everywhere present, eternal. God is. So we have to work with the written reports. There are many people who did good things that we don't have a written report about. That doesn't mean it wasn't important, because you see a church and you say, how did it come? Maybe there's a verbal tradition. But unless it's written documentation, or that somebody takes the verbal testimonies that people have given and writes it down, which I've done a lot of. When I go into, that's what led me to write books like In the Killing Fields of Mozambique, Holocaust in Rwanda, Faith in the Fine Sudan. I was there. I took down the people's testimonies. I got the dates, the names, the places, the events, where possible, photographs as well. Went to the places, confirmed, got several confirmations. History has to be documented, researched, and written. Now, sometimes we come across someone like Henry Morton Stanley, a journalist who traveled across Africa, and we get his reports, and so we're able to study and see, there's the sketches, here's the photographs, these are the details, and you're able to say, this is what they saw. Or David Livingstone, brilliant. His missionary travels is extraordinary. He gives you so much intricate details. There's so many sketches, like on Victoria Falls and on the wildlife and the customs of the people. This is what helps us to know and to plan and to put together our history. But while I am focusing on here, this is an incomplete manual. This is a beginning. I'm still working on this. And I've been working on other things like Greater Century Reformation, the Reformation 500 events and so on. But these 16 chapters in here is the beginnings of, and I'm intending to keep working till we've got a big Christian History of Africa book. This is just a manual. It's a work in progress. I'm still improving continually. One of our biggest problems is many of the societies were without a language or a written language and without written records. And so when you've got people have passed on a story, they might remember what their grandfather said, but few know what their great-grandfather said. And without writing, you lose a lot of history. And so it's important for us to see what we've got and build from there. Now, there are a lot more details than what I'm giving. I'm giving you a few short, condensed, polished presentations with as much visual as possible to help one realize we're trying to make videos of it, we're getting audios, we're getting it in the books. We're trying to get our African Christian history together. But obviously, some people wrote more than others. Livingstone, Stanley, the most. And so we've got a huge insight to the 19th century Christian movement in Africa from Livingstone and Stanley. So that we put in. C.T. Studd, we'll come to later, probably tomorrow. Brilliant, great insights. And this helps us to understand. And so you may say, well, I'd like to hear more about what the local Africans at the time were thinking. And I would too. But if we don't have the books, we are hamstrung. We need to find where are the written records, or where the photographs, or where the archaeological evidence, or what was drawn. We need something to work on. And the verbal, that's the problem with verbal. Verbal only lasts for a generation or two, maybe three generations. But after that, it sort of gets lost. But when it's written, I've found books that were written. I've got books on my shelves, printed in the 1600s. I've got some really old books and valuable ones that I've searched out. And I've personally focused on 19th century. I got my doctorate in 19th century missionary movement. In fact, the thesis for my doctorate was the motivations of Calvinism and of post-millennialism in inspiring the greatest century of missions in the 19th century. So I've focused on 19th century missionary movement personally more than anything else. Well, I love all history, and we will put in more on other times. But you see, of course, I'm a student of David Livingstone in particular. I could give you several weeks of lectures just on David Livingstone.